Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm joined today by my friend and author, Father Anthony Andreassi. Welcome, Father Anthony.
Tim, it's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Good to see you. Now, Anthony has written a new book, A History of Regis High School in New York City, which some of our listeners may be familiar with, and it's Teach Me to Be Generous, The First Century of Regis High School in New York City. Now, Anthony, you're a member of the Congregation of the Oratory, but you've taught in Jesuit schools for many years.
That's right, 17 years now.
First at in Washington, D.C., correct?
Oh, even earlier at Xavier for 2 years.
Oh, of course, yeah. And then Gonzaga, and then Gonzaga. Back here to New York. Now, let's start with the title, Teach Me to Be Generous. Where does that come from?
Well, it's that kind of iconic prayer of St. Ignatius, teach me to be generous, teach me to serve you as you deserve. Actually, one of my students, who's a very fine young man who's now in law school, Jimmy Simmons, he wrote a paper for me in his senior year on the related to the history of Regis and titled it, Teach Me to Be Generous. And I said to him afterwards, Jimmy, that's a great title. Do you mind if I borrow it for the book? And he graciously lent it to me. So
good. Well, we'll give him due credit. Now, why is it appropriate? I mean, people who know Regis know why, but why is it appropriate for Regis?
Because the school in its founding a century ago this year was founded by the incredible generosity of one woman and her family, subsequently her family for the next century. Their generosity in giving really enormous amounts of money over the last century is what built the school and kept it alive really for 10 decades now.
Yeah, the initial gift, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million, $2 million in 1914.
Right.
Which is an enormous sum at that time.
Right. You know, when you try to translate dollars across a century, it starts to limp. But when her husband died, the foundress, Mrs. Grant, when her husband died in 1910, he left her somewhere in the neighborhood of $9.5 million. And if you kind of do a little translation across, that's about $200 million in today's dollars. So she gave a little less than quarter of that to purchase the land, build the school, and then basically gave about another $800,000 in bonds that the school lived off the interest of for the next 7 decades.
Well, we'll talk more about Mrs. Grant and the founding family because they're an interesting story of themselves. But talk a little bit about Regis itself. Father Hearn, who was the founder, what was his vision? I mean, he was quite prescient in seeing a need here for a certain kind of Jesuit education.
So Father Hearn was a native of New England. He served for a while as the president of Xavier, the College of St. Francis Xavier, which still exists legally, but now only grants high school degrees, Xavier High School. While he was there in the very late 19th century, he and the other Jesuits there came under some criticism by the Archbishop and some prominent priests that Xavier was only educating the sons of the middle class or the upper middle class. And Hearn took this criticism seriously, and he knew his history, and he knew that when St. Ignatius founded the first schools, the first Jesuit schools, in 1547, 1548 in Sicily, they were absolutely free. In their constitution, the Jesuits are prohibited from charging for any of their ministries, whether they're saying Mass, hearing confessions, visiting the sick, or teaching children. So for the first 2.5 centuries of Jesuit schools, they were free or practically free. The only way to do it was to have wealthy patrons found the schools. For all sorts of reasons, that changed after the suppression and restoration of the society, which I guess we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of this year. So by the late 19th century, all the Jesuit high school, Jesuit schools around the U.S. were charging tuition. And this became a problem with the, you know, teeming number of poor immigrants into the cities who Xavier, Fordham, or then St. John's College, eventually Brooklyn College, were beyond their reach.
Well, it's interesting because you're right. There was the Jesuits had a reputation in some countries. You know, it was the Christian Brothers or the Irish Christian Brothers who taught the sons of the poor. It was the sons at that time. And it was the Jesuits who taught the sons of the more wealthy or middle class. I think it was James Joyce who was often critical of the Jesuits for that reason. So that was part of the cultural context here.
Absolutely. And my sense is by the 18th century, before the French Revolution, where Jesuit colleges, especially in France, became, there were so many of them, and they very much influenced the ones that were founded in the United States because of the influence of some French Jesuits here. The boarding schools, if you will, they were still technically free, but they charged very heavy boarding fees. So it was a little way around that.
Now, Father Hearn, an interesting figure, and one of the reasons we're interested in this story is because of the connections with the Ministry of America. And here was another founder who had this vision, and then soon after left. I mean, he reminded me of Father Wynne, who was the founder of America, and within a year was gone. So what happened in the case of Father Hearn?
Yes, and actually, it's interesting. Father Wynne was actually present at the funeral of Mayor Grant.
Right. Were they classmates?
I forget. I just can't remember what their connection was. Maybe they were classmates because he went to Xavier too. Okay. The research around this was it seemed like the first Jesuits of America were living up on 83rd Street in the community there where Hearn was the superior, not rector, but superior. And there are these very cryptic references in America magazine in what looked like sort of a news note section, thinly veiled attacks on Hearn. I found some documentation on this, but not enough really to put together a whole narrative to see what happened. Seemingly, it was a big argument, maybe personality-driven. I didn't get any sense it was ideological or theological or anything like that. And Hearn's disagreement with Jesuits in America and then ultimately with his own provincial. So shortly after a year of the opening of Regis, it opened September 1914. By the end of September 1915, Hearn was transferred to Buffalo, which, no disrespect to my friends from Buffalo, I think that might have been a bit of an exile. And he died shortly thereafter, within 3 years of that.
So let's go back to the Grants, the family, who for so long people didn't know who they were. So it was only recently, relatively recently, that it came out that they were in fact the original donors.
Correct, absolutely. The Mrs. Grant, the foundress, who was a widow at the time, and she basically used her husband's incredible wealth, though she was from a wealthy family herself. She used her husband's wealth to start Regis. From the very beginning, she demanded absolute anonymity. Unlike some other wealthy Catholic benefactors like the Bradys, who gave a lot of money to the society and other charities, but very much like their name associated with it. The Grants had three children, two of whom never married. The son only married in his late 60s. He had no children. His widow died in 2007, well into her 90s. So at the death of his widow, when the assets of the family, the artwork, furniture was being auctioned off, the auction house actually, in its publication, mentioned the connection between the Grant family and Regis. So a third party sort of revealed that. So when the school began thinking about history, it was very clear that it would be impossible to tell the story of Regis without the Grant family. I know some alumni were a bit disappointed to have the name revealed, but honestly, this book would be about half its length if you couldn't talk about the Grants.
Well, they're an interesting family in their own right. He was a mayor of New York, and I didn't know. Was it the first Irish-American mayor of New York?
Well, second. Grace.
Second, okay.
Yeah, Grace. So he was the second Irish-American mayor of New York, elected in 1888. He beat Abram Hewitt. It was great election where Abram Hewitt lost the Irish vote, largely over at least one issue dealing with the St. Patrick's Day parade. Isn't it amazing how
still
that parade?
Still a political issue.
Yes. He refused to fly the shamrock from City Hall, and he wanted to extend residency requirements for citizenship to 21 years. Again, immigration remains an issue. He paid dearly in the polls, and Hugh Grant was elected, who remains still the youngest man elected mayor in the city. He served two terms. They were two-year terms back then. He was a mostly honest mayor at a time of Tammany. Probably one of the things we're most thankful for, I think, even today, is the famous blizzard of 1888, where hundreds of New Yorkers died, many of whom were electrocuted by falling overhead power lines. He mandated all the utilities bury all the lines. So he was, in terms of public utilities, public sanitation, the very beginnings of exploration of building the subways.
That was the Croton Aqueduct also?
The second Croton Aqueduct system. And he also began the covering over of 4th Avenue or Park Avenue. Once the trains were electrified, he covered over the center malls, which helped to create Park Avenue into the, if you will, the toniest, avenue in New York City now.
Well, that's another contribution he made to Regis and its community, of course, because they're right off of Park
Avenue. Exactly.
Well, he was a very interesting figure. And am I wrong? Did he make some of his money, or at least his family, from saloon?
Absolutely.
Yeah. As a son of a restaurant owner, I can appreciate that.
Yeah, his father was an Irish immigrant. He and his parents died while he was still very young, still a boy. But they left him for the 1870s, they left him $500,000, which is a lot of money today. It was an enormous amount of money 150 years ago. And with that, he wound up going to Xavier College, Columbia Law School. And after, as a young man, as a newly minted lawyer, he began to reconnect with some of the Tammany connections his father had made, and then went into politics.
Now, another interesting tension here was, the idea of founding a school versus funding the work of seminaries. And that's something that at some point the Grants were actually criticized for by some members of the Jesuits.
That's right. He, it was during a time, the Church in America was expanding rapidly, trying to keep up with the demands of immigrants and new Catholics, and two laudable goals: building a high school for poor Catholic boys, and another laudable goal, creating another seminary, another house of studies for Jesuits in formation. Mrs. Grant decided she wanted to start a high school rather than do that, and some higher-level Jesuits thought that was a mistaken use of funds. They felt they had enough high schools already in New York, and they were stretched already too thin with their personnel. So quite a few tears were shed over this by Mrs. Grant, but the relationship remained between herself and, in fact, her family gave a lot of money. Her children gave a lot of money to the building of Shrub Oak, the old Jesuit, which I've never met a Jesuit who really liked his time in Shrub Oak. But for the years that it existed, they could have thanked the Grant family for giving a lot of the money toward the building of Shrub Oak.
Well, now, was this the theology school?
It was the philosophy
house. School, okay.
Yeah, Northern Westchester.
Northern Westchester, so... So they did wind up giving additional money, the Jesuits.
Oh, my gosh.
They were very generous. And you mentioned the Brady is another family. We actually just got a bunch of the furniture from their old their home in Long Island. Am I correct? That's where they had the
Absolutely.
Retreat house.
Right, in his father.
Which was recently sold, so a lot of that furniture is now at America House. So these connections keep continuing. Now, I should mention some of the America, there are America editors who went to Regis, Father Joe O'Hare being one, Father Peter Schneller, who was on staff. So, and then there were scholastics, like Father Vincent O'Keefe, who lived here in America for a long time, was a scholastic at Regis. Maybe you could talk a bit about the role of scholastics, because I think that's a story that was true of many Jesuit schools at the time.
So obviously, I know readers of America, many of them are familiar what a scholastic is or was in the days gone by before, say, 1970, when you had hundreds, thousands of scholastics in the United States who spent, on average, 3 years, 2 to 3 years, in their mid-20s, working at a high school. So you'd have these guys, 25 to 28, brimming with energy, having been, if you pardon the expression, cooped up in a novitiate for 2 years, philosophy studies, college studies. Now they're young, they're healthy, they're strong, and they're thrown into teaching in a high school. And they would have done everything from teach to coach sports to coach, moderate, speech and debate societies. And in addition, while there was this continual turnover every 3 years or so of each of these young men, they provided a living model of what it meant to be a young Jesuit. And actually, they were the best vocation poster you could have, because a young, healthy, happy, smart, young scholastic, a young boy in the 50s might say to himself, I could be just like him.
Yes, I was just sharing this story earlier. There's a Jesuit I know who said, when I was young and thinking about the priesthood, he didn't want to become a Jesuit priest. He wanted to become a Jesuit scholastic. So Those were his heroes.
Right.
And I think that's a lesson the Jesuits certainly have learned in trying as much as they can these days to place young Jesuits in those positions.
We had a scholastic recently at Regis, the first one in a while, and wonderful man. He was ordained last year, and several of the boys who are now in college went to the ordination. And nowadays, it's rare for young people to see someone on their way to be a priest, and then also to have that personal relationship with them in the classroom. So,
now that's one part of the story of Jesuit schools. These scholastics were such a vibrant part. Another part is, at least in New York, and I'm sure it's a story of many Jesuit schools throughout the country, you had, maybe it was just one, but you had a Jesuit who was there pretty much almost his whole career. And at Fordham Prep, where I went, that was Father Jack Leonard. At Regis, where I had two brothers go to, I think it was Father Vincent Taylor. And at Regis, at Xavier.
Vincent, right.
And at Regis, it was Father Duffy, who was there for over 50 years. So the Jesuits seemed to know that they wanted somebody who could bring a kind of stability and institutional memory.
Yeah, my sense, and this is just, I haven't done enough research on this, but before the council, guys would have been moved around. People could stay in a place 10, 12 years, but after the council, there was a little more flexibility in staying. So Father Duffy, who unfortunately I never had the opportunity to meet, he spent 50 years, many of those years working full-time and then working as a tutor part-time, and remained an enormous connection with alumni. There was a priest there in the 30s and 40s, Father Zima, who he and his brother, Demetrio and Gabriele Zima, from I should remember if they were born in Calabria, but their parents were from Calabria. They were from the Lower East Side, from one of the Nativity Parish. And he was there for about a decade and a half and really founded the Alumni Association. And he kept up with many of the young men, especially those who served in the war. So whenever you had a priest who had been there for a while, he could kind of keep strong connections. And I'm trying to make a point that because Jesuits, part of the Jesuit spirituality and teaching is you're teaching the whole person, body, mind, soul. The care of that individual soul would continue after graduation. So you see that in a way that you might not see in a private school or even a public school where there is a continuing connection between those back then, only those men who went to the school and the Jesuits there.
We should also mention, of course, there were lay staff who stayed there for generations. And at a time when there was perhaps more movement among Jesuits, those lay staff kept the institutional identity.
Absolutely. I made a point of dedicating several pages to the men who taught there. And again, it was men really before the late 1960s who made a career as a layman working in these Jesuit schools. There was always a kind of a turnover of young teachers who would leave very often to make more money in a public school. But then you had these, pardon the expression, sort of these grand Catholic gentlemen. I'm sure, Tim, you've had some of them at Fordham Prep who very often married, raising children themselves, but were really, their vocation was to teach in this school. And there, I wrote about several of them who spent decades there. And when there was that constant turnover of Jesuits, there were those few laymen. There's a teacher who I think taught one or both of your brothers at Regis, John Connolly, who's in his 52nd year at Regis. So he's the next generation of those doing that.
Well, full disclosure, I should have revealed this earlier, but I did have two brothers go to Regis, so and I went to Fordham Prep, proud Fordham Prep graduate. Oh, and one of those lay teachers sold copies of America in the classroom, so that's perhaps a tradition we want to start
that's
again.
That's right.
Now, maybe we can move ahead to Vatican II and the changes at the school then, because again, I guess I think this is something a lot of Jesuit schools went through. What were the challenges going from a more traditional, perhaps pious, pre-Vatican II spirituality focused on solidarity groups and those sort of things, sodality groups, different, to, you know, more experimental liturgies.
Right, and that chapter with all the changes at Regis between, say, 1965 and 1980, both in the classroom pedagogically as well as outside the classroom, everything from dress code, the rules governing student life, and finally to what you just mentioned, on the religious life, the spiritual life of the school, in some ways, I think people who went to other Jesuit schools during that period, while the names might be different, the experiences would probably be, I would think, largely the same. Apart from maybe the sisters, American nuns, who really took the Second Vatican Council to heart in the deepest way and went out to the margins and experimented, Society of Jesus in this country probably ran a close second. And in every level of their institute, in all parts of their institutions, including their high school. So there was all this experimentation, the sodalities, as you just mentioned, which they disappeared almost overnight, but they had been around since the middle of the 16th century. What we might call them today, they were lay prayer groups, if you will, where young people, young men in the Jesuit schools of the 16th century, they get together for prayer, for fellowship, and what we might now call practical acts of charity. That continued for four centuries. In the late 1960s, some of the more, what we would now call more pious, more pre-Vatican II methods of prayer were done away with. And I might say not anything immediately came to replace them. Other things were experimented with, community action programs, but there's been no staying power in an exact way. A lot of the social justice component of the school programs kind of, in some ways, replaced them. But I don't see an exact replacement for them.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, just a sign of some of the, you know, it was a time of a lot of change in the church, and this was reflected in the school, where in the newspaper there was some, you know, some hostility towards the traditional spirituality. And somebody actually wrote, you know, screw Mass, I'd rather walk in a forest or an open field. So this was kind of the idea. It's like, why do we need Mass? Why do we need these traditional liturgies when I can just encounter God outside, you know? So it's compared to then, I mean, the spiritual life of the school seems a little more traditional, and that's, I think, the case of many Catholic schools.
I would say, yeah, I would say those were very heady days. I mean, even outside of liturgical or spiritual stuff, there was a period where, at Regis, where students would enter into contracts with their teachers on what they would learn, what they wanted to learn, in tremendous amount of unstructured time, where that was pulled back from pretty quickly. There was a period where there was almost no dress code, or as the dress code was entitled, clean and neat with covered shoes. And my sense is it probably Regis had the most, if you will, progressive, unstructured dress code of all the area Jesuit high schools. But already by the mid to late 70s, they were pulling back from that. It paralleled so much of what was happening in the wider zeitgeist, if you will. I mean, even to one last thing, I mean, you could see by, you know, whereas about 8 to 10% of the graduating class would go on to seminaries or the Jesuit novitiate, within 5 years, that you were down to one guy. So for those of us who lived grew up since the 1980s, where change has been much more slower, I think it's hard, though we can be very critical of, maybe some people would be very critical of what happened then, it's hard to imagine how quickly things were changing then.
And because Regis was, you know, such an academically elite school, and it was tuition-free, it was dealing with these issues maybe a little earlier than some of the other Jesuit schools. For example, when it started opening up, allowing its students to apply to non-Catholic schools, immediately it did very well in the Ivy League and stuff,
right,
and other such elite schools. So it became an issue right away, that suddenly there was a big drop-off in the Catholic school attendance.
That's right. And that some older alumni who graduated, say, before the early 60s still harbor some resentment they were not allowed to apply to non-Catholic colleges, with some rare exceptions, engineering schools, the military academies. But the way it was understood, the way the Jesuits understood it there, we were forming you in the Catholic faith, and we wanted you to go to a college where you would remain supported in that faith. Obviously, with the opening of the Second Vatican Council, greater openness to secular society, that changed.
Now, maybe we could talk a bit about, you know, what's changed in 100 years. Early on, these were students who desperately needed a tuition-free option. I mean, they had nowhere else to go, perhaps. Now, you have students who perhaps could afford a Jesuit school, if not, you know, a Tony private school in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. How does Regis try to balance that in terms of being true to its original mission, but also trying to remain, you know, academically competitive?
Yes, I would say for the first third of the school's life, say from 1914 through the Second World War, the vast majority of the boys who went to Regis were poor and would not have been able to afford a Jesuit education if their parents had to pay for it. As evidence to that, you have many, many elements of evidence in that, including the fact that in the 20s, you had large numbers of boys leaving school because they got jobs to support their family. And that would be written on their record card, if you will, left for a job. With the rise, you know, the post-war prosperity, the rise of the middle class, the Catholics moving into the middle class in huge numbers, that began to change. As early as the late 1960s, the school was recognizing this as a problem. The fact the school was founded for Catholic boys who otherwise could not afford a Jesuit education, now fewer and fewer of those kind of boys seem to be around. So 40 years now, the school has been taking that seriously. Various ways were implemented to try to address that. Probably the most significant and definitely the most long-lasting has been the REACH program, Reaching for Academic Excellence in Catholic High School, R-E-A-C-H. What that program has done is isolated or identified talented fifth grade boys from, you know, poorer or more challenged economic backgrounds starting in sixth grade, give them sort of a boot camp of enrichment work, 20 Saturdays during the year, 6 weeks in the summer, at all at no cost, so that when they sit for the Regis entrance exam, they will be on par to the young men who are coming from much better funded public schools in the suburbs or better funded Catholic schools.
It's been generally, has it been successful at bringing some of these students to the Regis?
Yeah, front? So I'm pretty sure the incoming Regis class, which will arrive this fall, 14 or 15 of those of the class are Reach graduates, if you will.
Now, it seems to me that one of the reasons this is interesting, this is a challenge I think that all Jesuit schools are facing in some way, but it's more clear-cut and obvious at Regis because it's tuition-free. Because you have that gift, there's a mandate to try to serve this population. Whereas, you know, there are Jesuit schools who, you know, are getting quite expensive now, and I'm sure they struggle with how to make it affordable to people from poorer backgrounds. But because it's tuition-free, the issues are all the more clear-cut.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would even say obviously professional economist, but with the disappearance or the continuing shrinking of the middle class, it's very expensive to run a school, extraordinarily expensive. And to, you know, places like Fordham Prep and Xavier, which have, you know, tuitions north of $14,000, it's very hard to pay that, you know, earning less $60,000 a year, maybe a single parent family. So, of course, Regis has a particular mission since its origin was so closely identified with the poor.
And you're right. I mean, here's a time where with rising inequality, the disappearance of a large section of the middle class, maybe, the Jesuit schools are called to serve some of those who have been left behind. And one model is the Cristo Rey model.
Absolutely.
Which has some parallels with the early history of Regis.
You're right. Whereas, while it's not absolutely free, it's pretty close to it. It's within the reach, can be very much in the reach of the poor. One thing that I found that I've made a point of saying when talking with alumni and friends of the school is one of the conditions for entrance into Regis in the early years was you had to be a graduate of a parochial school. Now, while we all still know what that term means, it had a particular meaning then. A parochial school meant a parish school, obviously, and for many decades, up through the 1960s, parish schools were free or almost free. Unlike some other schools run by the nuns and the brothers, academies, which tended to charge a higher tuition. A Convent of the Sacred Heart, for example. Now, the sisters did that not because they were lining their pockets. They did it. It was kind of a creative form of financing. They would charge a higher tuition to wealthier families for girls or boys, and smaller class sizes, little extras. So you'd have that academy, and maybe down the block or down the road, the same order of sisters were staffing the elementary school, where the pastor of that elementary school was probably giving barely enough to keep body and soul together for those sisters. So that's kind of how they were forming the Catholic educational system. So by saying you were a graduate of a parochial school meant your parents were sending you to a school that was free or almost free. They were not the extras. So that was, for me, that was a very important thing to alight to. And then Father Kilroy, who was one of the, literally was registering the first boys in June of 1914, he was interviewed later in his life. And he clearly remembers the boys being almost exclusively from poor backgrounds. Nobody asked to see, I know the income tax was brand new, nobody asked to see income tax returns back then. And there surely were a few boys who came from a little wealthier background, but the vast majority were poor.
Now, we should mention it is still an all-boys school, and obviously that's how it was founded and how all Jesuit schools were founded. And most Jesuit schools in New York City remain to be all-boys, although Loyola is co-ed. That's also been an issue that's come up. Because it's tuition-free, should there be a Catholic option for girls that's tuition-free?
Yes. I mean, in fact, kind of a funny story is when Cardinal Farley, who was the Archbishop, got wind that the Jesuits had come into this windfall of cash, if you will. He called Hearn in and said, I heard you got $3 million. And Hearn was pretty annoyed that he had been called. And in fact, in a letter to another Jesuit, he reminded him, he said, I could have told him I didn't have to talk about this because as a pontifical order, they can raise money without permission of the bishop. But in keeping neighborly relations, if you will, he said, no, Your Eminence, we only got about $1.5 million. Because the reason why Farley was asking was he had just started Cathedral Girls High School just a few years earlier. and he wanted that to be a free high school for girls. To be honest, I was a little surprised. We don't often think in the early 20th century of Catholic archbishops being forward-seeing on education of women, but actually here was an example of that. But at that point, it was unthinkable for adult men to teach teenage girls. In fact, as late as the, as recently, if you will, as the late 1920s, Pius XI was condemning coeducation. It was a different world back then.
And because of the stipulations of the original gift, that can't be changed. I know that's been some controversy.
Yeah, and I'm not a lawyer, but I do know this, that recent, as one of the various ways the money was left to the school, one of the ways it said the school must always get Middle States accreditation. And the school's actually now getting NYSIS, New York State Association of Independent Schools, in conjunction with Middle States. They went to the one of the courts, I'm sorry, I'm not bringing up the right name, to see if that could be changed. The court said absolutely no, because that was the intention of the benefactor. So whether it could be changed, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure there would be some argument, was that against the will of Mrs. Grant? Why only boys? She met Father Hearn. Jesuits ran schools for boys. I don't think there's much more to it than that.
Well, finally, maybe you can just speak a little bit to how your background. I mean, you've taught many years at Jesuit schools, but you yourself are not a Jesuit. You're a member of the Congregation of the Oratory, but you're also a historian. How do you think that you had a perspective as somebody who was sympathetic to the mission, but also had a little bit of distance to it to tell this story?
I hope so. I mean, I've been very blessed to work alongside Jesuits for the last 17 years. Who've always treated me as a colleague and an equal. I've been a priest now for 7 years of the Oratory. I'm not a graduate. Also, I'm not a graduate of Regis. So maybe that is better. If I had been a Jesuit graduate of Regis who wrote the history, it could be an exercise in self-congratulations. Father Phil Judge, the president of Regis, when he really commissioned this book, asked me to write it some years ago, he wanted it to be an intellectually honest, critical history of the school. Every time I wrote a chapter, I showed it to him, and he never once asked me to change anything. And like any human institution, although founded by very pious Catholic women and run by Jesuits, there have been disagreements, there have been fights over the last century, and those are all chronicled in there. Otherwise, it would have been just an exercise in, you know, alumni relations or coffee table book. And we wanted it, Father Judge and myself wanted it to be something more that I studied American Catholic history at Georgetown and wanted to write something that was a serious work of scholarship.
Well, congratulations, and congratulations to Regis on their 100th anniversary. So we want to thank Father Anthony Andreassi for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.